Welcome to the program, and I hope you've enjoyed an excellent week. In his book, Vaster Than Sky, Greater Than Space, the Advaita master, Muji, tells a beautiful story of a man who was apparently undisturbed by anything. Or was he? I'm going to let Muji tell us this story he calls A Twig Away from Nirvana, and this is what he writes. There once was a man who was beautifully dispassionate, kind and detached from everything. He was so empty of himself, so quiet, that he was almost invisible. He was married and had children, whom he loved dearly, but he was not attached to them either. Nothing seemed to bother him. Even when he came home from work early one day and walked in on his wife having a great time in bed with a milkman, he simply said, "Oh, hello, how are you, dear? I see that you have a friend over. Enjoy, enjoy, don't let me interrupt you. Shall I perhaps make you both a cup of tea?" He used to say to his wife, "Whatever makes you happy makes me happy." But his wife only thought, "What kind of man is this? Most men who walk in on their wives would become furious or at least feel betrayed. But this one is not worried about anything at all." And so, uncomprehending and unappreciative of his true detachment, she said to him, "You're a good person, but I need a real man." And so she left him. Then his children confronted him. "What kind of father are you anyway? Everyone knows the scandalous story and your strange reaction. You're a terrible father. The milkman would be a better dad than you." He responded in his clear, peaceful way, "Oh yes, you're probably quite right. I'm not such a good father." Even more infuriated by his continued detachment, his children said, "We don't want to have anything to do with you." And he was now left quite alone. But as he was unattached to any particular outcome, he was unperturbed by his family's judgments. So he went on his way, and after a while he found himself in a monastery. He was deeply content with his work there, which was to clean and rake the sand of the Zen garden into beautiful circles. He did this with great care, and afterwards he would sit on a rock in meditation. But he didn't have to meditate because he was meditation itself, completely absorbed in his being. So detached, so quiet, so empty was he that he even started to become invisible. Those walking through the Zen garden very often wouldn't notice him at all. Now the king of demons heard about him and called for his best or worst demons. He bellowed, "It has come to my notice that a mere mortal is about to slip into nirvana. Who is responsible for this one? You're supposed to be watching over him. How could you allow this?" Then the demons responded, "Your Majesty, we already have him under surveillance." "Well, how could you allow him to become so transparent? He's disappeared almost entirely. We simply cannot allow this." "But my lord, we've tried everything. We've sent every test in his way. We sent the milkman to his house to seduce his wife. But he seemed completely untroubled. And then his wife and children rejected him, and he took it all in his stride. We've done everything we can think of, and we just cannot get to him. We don't know what else to do." The king of the demons said, "He's still a mortal creature. There must be something you can find to distract him. We cannot afford for even one single human being to escape. You know how much trouble they cause when that happens. Now go and pay a close attention to him. Everyone has a weakness, and we must find his." "Yes, your majesty," they bowed, and off they went. Now one day, our detached monk had raked the gardens beautifully, and he was sitting on his favorite rock. He took a deep breath and was soon in deep meditation. The demons arrived and took their stations all around him, paying very close attention to his every move. But he simply sat there, almost invisible, so deeply immersed was he in his meditation. At one point, the demon sitting closest to him even started going into meditation. Another demon had to shake him and said, "Hey, don't get so close." And he quickly moved away to a safer distance. The demons were there for hours, just watching and waiting. Then a mighty wind started to blow through the hills and over the garden, shaking the big banyan tree that shaded it. Many leaves began to fly about, and one twig fell right on the part of the garden that the monk had so carefully raked. Now the leaves quickly blew away, but that one twig was just sitting there in the immaculate Zen garden. Immediately, the monk opened one eye to see what had happened and quickly climbed down from the rock to remove the offending twig. He threw it away irritably and then oh so carefully smoothed the sand before resuming his lotus posture. All the demons looked at each other with sly grins and went, "Aha!" The demons started to shake the tree so hard that twigs and leaves were falling everywhere. Then they danced on the sand, scattering it all over. The monk, totally flustered and confused, yelled and ran about trying to fix the impossible mess. He was so deeply disturbed that he lost his invisibility and even turned bright green. And that is how the demons blocked our monk from Nirvana, earning them the king's favor and a hero's welcome when they returned to the land of the demons. So that is how the demons won and the monk lost. Now, incidentally, you can find Muji himself telling the story on YouTube in a video titled A Zen Monk. I can recommend watching it, even though I've been a spoiler. Muji has an extraordinary presence and is a wonderful and funny storyteller. Okay, but now, while we let the story sink in, let's think about our motivation for being here in the program today, and if it's not so good, to change it. What is the greatest motivation? Well, how about bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for all beings? It's a motivation not only concerned with alleviating the suffering and discomfort of only one or two beings, but all the beings there are in the whole of existence. Isn't that pretty awesome? And that is why it's regarded as the best kind of motivation. We've always tried to make that the motivation for the program, so following that habit, let's do so again today. But if you do find it too daunting, at least participate so that you can realize enlightenment for your own ultimate well-being. Thank you. Now, why do you think I started the program off with Muji's story today? Well, if you were with us last time, you may remember we ended up talking about a particular slogan, "Whichever occurs, be patient with both," from Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, the text we've been following for the last little while. In the last program, it was explained that this meant that whatever arose in our lives, be it good or bad, we should accept it with patience. In fact, nothing is really good or bad. It is only the conditioned mind that labels it that way, but then believes in what it has fabricated. We would be better advised to follow the old farmer in the story of the runaway horse, who viewed everything with the attitude, "We'll see, who knows what is good, what is bad." As Pema Chodron wrote in Start Where You Are, "Whether it is glorious or wretched, delightful or hateful, be patient." Patience means allowing things to unfold at their own speed, rather than jumping in with your habitual response to either pain or pleasure. The real happiness that underlies both gloriousness and wretchedness often gets short-circuited by our jumping too fast into the same habitual pattern. In other words, we have to be very mindful of what is happening moment to moment, give ourselves time for action or reaction. It seems in Muji's story that at first the monk-to-be has this ability to be patient with everything that occurs in his life, even the infidelity of his wife and the desertion of his kids. Nothing, it seems, can disturb his equanimity. He can take everything in his stride. Interesting, isn't it, that it is when he becomes a monk, one who's supposed to be completely renounced, that attachment arises in the form of the immaculateness of a Zen garden. In fact, the demons didn't really have to do anything. A tiny demon was still living in his own apparently spotless mind. In line with this, Muji, in his commentary, directs us, his readers, to look into what brings up our distress. "What is your twig?" Meaning, what will bring up powerful distractions in you, he asks. And then continues, "Now hearing this, you might think, oh my God, this is terrible. I'll have to be so unattached and so vigilant, I will always need to be sweeping my inner house." And this is true. we have to be very mindful of what is coming and going and not try to interfere, not try to solidify what can never ever be solid. But Muji has a better solution, though I wouldn't say it's all that much easier than being extra vigilant. He says, but this is only the case if you insist on being a person. As soon as it becomes clear that the person itself is phenomenal, twig or no twig, it doesn't matter to you. You're not fighting personal battles anymore. However, this doesn't mean that powerful mind attacks will not come, sometimes even without an apparent twig or trigger. Nor does it mean that such attacks mean anything in particular. If such a storm should arise, you must bring it to the inquiry. Don't so much ask what the trigger is, rather ask for whom does it matter? Who is the one who is bothered? Who still carries some identity? And be grateful for the opportunity to inquire, for the opportunity to see where the ego is still hiding. Although this monk was almost completely free, there was still some attachment at play. So there was the need for that twig to fall on his garden in order to expose why he was still not completely free. The need to look this way will be there for as long as we continue to identify personally. But don't ask when the need for inquiry will end. As one deepens in understanding, self-inquiry becomes a joy and often arises spontaneously. It also does not end in the way that the mind would like, with one reaching some final destination. The inquiry is finished when there's no one left to inquire. So that's Muji. And we could say that the practice of patience in both good times and bad is leading us to the state where we no longer have to practice patience at all. For if there's no person to identify with, there's no person to practice. But we are now approaching the state of selflessness, and that, notwithstanding what Muji says, is no easy matter. We've been associating for so long with a process of personality creation that the habits formed in that creation are very hard to resist. Even when we come as close as the monk did, we still have to be careful, for the eye sense knows how to hide and how to subvert even the best situations to its own purpose. Our wife, our husband and kids may not be the triggers, but maybe the falling of a mere twig can detonate our peace, and then the practice of patience has to start out all over again. But now let's look at another commentary on this slogan, whichever arises, be patient with both. In his book, 7-Point Mind Training, B. Allen Wallace translates the slogan as, whichever of the opposites occurs, be patient, and says, the polarities referred to in this fourth practice are good fortune and misfortune. When we meet with good fortune, we tend to respond with attachment to the situation. Getting a raise or a promotion, being praised or coming into wealth, all commonly produce a sense of self-inflation. A more beneficial response to good fortune is not allowing our mind to come under the domination of the 8 worldly concerns of momentary pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, good and bad reputation. The point is to respond with a greater sense of inner stability and equanimity. Of course, we enjoy the good fortune. Being a Buddhist does not require being a spoilsport with a glum face. But avoiding attachment, conceit, or a sense of superiority does require patience in the face of good fortune. He goes on to admit that patience is an odd word in this context, but equates it with, and I quote, the same clarity and calmness of mind that helps us to avoid getting flustered in the face of adversity. He then continues, likewise for the opposite polarity. It is easy when we meet with misfortune, poverty, loss of reputation or status in our job, or a calamity such as the loss of a loved one, to lose enthusiasm for Dharma in the depths of our disillusionment. But instead of succumbing to despair in the face of adversity, seek to cultivate that inner strength, which is really what patience is about. Inner courage as ballast for your vessel of life. He goes on to relate this to a superficial judgment of Dharma practice which relies on outward circumstances. When life is treating us well, we feel that Dharma is good, he says. We might give it half an hour every day religiously and think that the job is done because the rest of our waking day is going so well. A Dharma practitioner should view the pleasures of a good job, a healthy family situation, comfortable living circumstances and a sound economy with suitable delight, as we would look at a very pleasant painting balanced upon a structure of matchsticks. This is happiness due to pleasant external stimuli, which by and large are beyond our control. A Buddhist response is not in any way to begrudge these mundane pleasures, but at the same time not to use them as a substitute for Dharma practice. This is not so obvious during the good times, but it becomes very apparent, maybe a little too late, during the bad times. That is B. Alan Wallace. And Judy Leaf, in her commentary on tricycle.org, makes the same point. She says, what happens to your practice when you are extremely happy, when things are going especially well? And what happens to your practice when things are going horribly and you're not doing well at all? That is what this slogan is about, and the advice is to be patient in either case. It is hard to practice mind training steadily, so we come up with all kinds of excuses to avoid facing our own state of mind and opening to others. Whether we are feeling pain or pleasure, are sad or happy, we get taken over by the intensity and the drama of the situation, and we lose our bearings. When our situation is bright, we indulge in it and milk it for all it's worth. Since things are going well for us, we don't feel any need to practice. We're caught up in our own pleasure and our wish to maintain it, so we focus on ourselves and forget about others. Mind training and the cultivation of loving kindness are thrown out the window. When we are suffering and things are not going well, we also turn inward. We think, why me? And get caught up in the mentality of whining and complaint. Although we might think about practice, we're too miserable to relate with it. Our excuse is that we just don't have the right conditions to practice right now, so we need to wait for conditions to improve. So again, mind training is ditched, in this case, due to our preoccupation with our own misery. Instead of waiting for the right conditions to come about, the idea of the slogan is to apply mind training steadily and consistently. In fact, every condition is a right condition for mind training. And that is Judy Leaf. Now, part of the mind training is to understand why we find ourselves in the situation we're in and apply that understanding to the way that we are reacting to it. When things are going badly, why are they like that? Jamyong Kontrol, in The Great Path of Awakening, an easily accessible introduction for ordinary people, reminds us that if we are able to look deeply enough, we would see it's because of negative karma. We did something that caused suffering in the past, maybe in a past life, and the result of that is ripening right now. He says, when we feel resentful or get depressed about our situation, it is useful to remember this, and instead of sinking further and further into misery, to accept the situation as well as we can, determining not to create such causes again. In the meantime, we can do whatever we can to purify our negative karma and obscurations to create positive outcomes for the future. We can also practice Tonglen, that is, not only accepting our own misery, but the miseries and sufferings of all other beings at the same time. You could be amazed how effective this practice is at lifting the mind and making the suffering appear worthwhile. Of course, if we just concentrate on our own misery and intense wish to be free of it, the suffering will just bite harder and stay longer. But if in our mind we take on the suffering of others so that they do not have to bear those sufferings, if we really have the wish to do that and strongly imagine doing it, our suffering will decrease dramatically. Then actually the suffering becomes beneficial, not harmful. On www.rickhansen.net, Dr. Rick Hansen has written a blog that explains why it is harmful not to recognize the suffering of others, and it is brave to do so. He first points out the obvious, that we certainly know when we ourselves are suffering, whether it is intense or only slight, but we're not so awake as to when others are going through the same thing. Especially as the news is so full of every type of misery, we can easily become numb to it all. But, he says, even in our own home, we often don't catch the pain in the lives of those near and dear to us. He says, close to home, it's easy to tune out or simply miss the stress and strain, unease and anger in the people we work, live and even sleep with. This creates problems for others, of course. Often what matters most to another person is that someone bears witness to his or her suffering, that someone just really gets it. It's a wound and a sorrow when this doesn't happen. And at the practical level, if their suffering goes unnoticed, they're unlikely to get help. And then he makes a very important point. He says, plus, not seeing suffering harms you as well. You miss information about the nature of life, miss chances to have your heart opened, miss learning what your impact on others might be. Small issues that could have been resolved early on grow until they blow up. People don't like having their pain overlooked, so they're more likely to overreact or be uncharitable towards you when you're the one having a hard time. Wars and troubles that seem so distant come rippling across our own borders. To paraphrase John Donne, if we don't heed the faraway tolling of the bell for others, it will eventually come tolling for thee and me. He suggests that we purposely take more notice, open our eyes to the faces around us as we move through our day. Notice the weariness, the bracing against life, the weariness, irritability, he says. Sense the suffering behind the words. Feel in your body what it would be like for you to have the life of the other person. But he also advises us not to be overwhelmed by it all. We need only take it in small doses. He says again, if it helps, bring to mind some of the happy truths of life, or the sense of being with people who love you. Know that there are 10,000 causes upstream of each person leading to this present moment. So much complexity, so hard to blame a single factor. And then open up again to the suffering around you, to a child who feels like an afterthought, a worker who fears a layoff, a couple caught up in anger. Don't glide over faces on the evening news. See the suffering in the eyes looking back at you. Watch and listen to those closest to you. What's hurting over there? Face it, even if you have to admit that you are one of its causes. If appropriate, ask some questions and talk about the answers. How does it feel to open to suffering? You could find that it brings you closer to others and that there's more kindness coming back your way. You could feel more grounded in the truth of things, particularly in how it is actually for the people around you. Take heart. Opening to suffering is one of the bravest things you can do. That is Dr. Rick Hansen. And someone, I can't recall right now, said that it was actually a privilege to share in the suffering of others. And if we take it as such, it ennobles us. But then, going back to Jamrun Kuntral, we find that he also talks about dealing with the other polarity, there where things are going well. He says, if you find yourself very happy and comfortable, surrounded by great wealth and servants, don't succumb to carelessness or indifference. Use the wealth for virtuous projects. Use your power constructively. And pray for all sentient beings to have the same comfort and happiness. This is how he recommends being patient with good fortune. Now, I recently read about an Instagram account known as Rich Russian Kids, set up by one of those very kids. It boasts various photos and videos of how the mega-rich kids live in Russia, and they are the very definition of luxury and profligence, carelessness and indifference. News.au.com wrote an article about four of them who rode around St. Petersburg in a car blasting out gangster rap while they threw a small fortune in bank bills out the window. "Ha ha, take hundreds of dollars, you little people," one was heard to say. I guess this is not how Jamam Kuntral would envisage using wealth and power constructively. Actually, one article on the Russian rich kids says that they spend so much so quickly because they don't know whether some high-up government official will take a dislike to anyone in their family, and whoops, the fortune will disappear overnight and they will find themselves in jail. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche talks about this as well in Enlightened Courage, not about the rich Russian kids. He was a bit before their time, but about being rich. He says, through faith in the three jewels and the practice of generosity, it could happen that by way of karmic fruit, we become rich, gain a high position in society, and so on. This might lead us to think, I am rich, I'm important, I'm the best, I've come out on top. If we practitioners have this kind of arrogance, our clinging to this life will increase and a demon will enter our hearts. If, on the other hand, we manage to enjoy happiness, possessions, and influence without pride, we will understand that they are nothing but illusions, insubstantial dreams, all of which will one day fade away. For as it is said of all compounded things, what is accumulated will be used up. What is raised up will fall. What is born will die. What is joined together will separate. Who knows, we should tell ourselves, perhaps tomorrow I shall have to say goodbye to all of this. Therefore, I will offer my teachers and the three jewels the best of my contentment and possessions. May they accept it with joy and bless me so that I may have no obstacles on the path. All of it is just a pleasant dream, but may all beings experience such happiness as mine and even more. On the other hand, when we are in such poor shape that we cannot even practice, that we have strong emotions and feelings of irritation, fighting and quarreling with everyone, we should reflect, I know that everything is illusory. I will therefore not allow myself to be carried away by my feelings. I will not be a coward. I will shoulder the weakness, poverty, illness, and death of other beings. To put it briefly, we should be able to think that, provided that the precious bodhicitta does not decrease in us, who cares if we have to go to the lower realms? Who cares if we lose our possessions? Come what may, like beggars with a precious jewel, we will not forsake bodhicitta. So says Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And that is where we'll have to leave the program today, for now our time is up. Thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Please dedicate the positive potential to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. Thanks, and goodbye.